Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. In a couple weeks, look for an interview with Dr. Stephen Meyer of the Discovery Institute on his new book, Darwin's Doubt. We'll be interviewing Dr. Meyer. He's an old earth creationist, not unlike Dr. Hugh Ross. We are biblical creationists here at Bob Inyart Live. But it will be an interesting interview, no doubt. The book is Darwin's Doubt. And then also, we have this Friday, coming up in Denver, a meeting of the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. And at this meeting, we attempt to attend every month. We have the plan to be there this Friday, which is July 12th, to hear Dr. Jay Wiley and an amazing topic. So why don't we go right through a while. Welcome to Bob Inyart Live.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
So your talk is on a topic that is of big interest to me, and it has to do with the half-life of elements that are radioactive. So that's a bit of a technical topic, and our audience on Wednesday is not always as technical as our Real Science Friday, Real Science Radio program. So could you help us understand first the issue of radioactive elements and how they decay, and then what a half-life is?
Well, radioactive elements are a lot like teenage girls. They don't like themselves very much, and they want to change.
Okay.
And so a radioactive isotope actually wants to become some other atom, and it usually does this by spitting out a bit of itself. Mm. So it'll spit out an alpha particle or a beta particle, which are just, you know, things inside the nucleus, and when that happens, that changes the atom to something else. And now most atoms in nature aren't radioactive, but there are some that are, and they change into other atoms in a particular way that leads to a particular rate.
Go ahead, Dr. Weil. For example, uranium, thorium, carbon-14. These are radioactive. They don't like themselves. They want to be something else. And so, right. So what happens? How do they become something else?
Well, so something like carbon-14, for example, you mentioned it. It actually emits what's called a beta particle. That beta particle allows it to change. It actually allows a proton to become a neutron. And that changes the carbon into a completely different element. That element is now nitrogen. And so it does that by emitting a bit of itself, and that changes its constituents of protons and neutrons, which makes it a different element entirely.
And so then there is a method of trying to estimate how old something might be by looking at, well, how much of the parent element is here in a sample? Let's say it's a dinosaur bone or whatever. And how much of the daughter element that it decayed into is here? And then if we could figure out how long it takes for that radioactive element to decay, perhaps we could figure out how long, how old a bone is, a rock strata is, maybe the whole Earth for that matter.
Right. And the problem is the only thing you measure is how much is there now. Mm. So you have to make an assumption about how much was there originally, so that you know how much has decayed. And then you have to know how fast the radioactive substance decays. Now, we've been measuring the speed of radioactive decay for the last 100 years or so. And over that time period, it seems like radioactive substances decay according to what's called a half-life. Hmm. In a certain amount of time, half of the isotope decays. And then in that same amount of time, another half decays. And so a radioisotope keeps cutting itself in half each of the same amount of time.
And
that's been the case for the last 100 years or so. And what people who want to believe in an old Earth do is they say, well, you know, we've been measuring these radioactive half-lives for 100 years and they've stayed stable. So I'm going to assume they've stayed stable for billions of years.
Right, right.
And as a result, then, they assume how much stuff was in the artifact initially. They measure how much is now. They assume that the half-life has always been the same.
And they
come
up
coming up with ages, depending on the method and so forth, of up to billions of years
now,
for the age of rocks.
Now, Dr. J. Weil, my producer for this segment, is from Rochester, New York. Is that right? Rochester? Close enough.
Yeah, Rochester.
And you attended the University of Rochester, where you earned your PhD in nuclear chemistry, right? So you're speaking as someone who is well-informed on this topic.
Oh, this is strictly in my field, yes.
Right. Yeah,
and so that's why I'm so skeptical of the standard ages given for the Earth and for rocks and for fossils and so forth, because I know enough about radioactive dating to realize how poor it really is.
Mm. I enjoy Dr. Stephen Meyer's work from the Discovery Institute. Even though he's an old Earth Christian, he's against evolution. And in his new book, Darwin's Doubt, he wrote something that I had a chuckle about. He said that when we use a molecular clock to try to determine how old one, like humans, might have diverged from a chimp-like creature, he said there are a lot of factors that, you know, could be very complicated. He said, but there's nothing like that when it comes to radioactive dating. That's all as pure as the driven snow. And I just chuckled, and he has a background in geophysics. So I don't understand quite how he could have said that, but he said it.
Well, I think, even though you have a background in geophysics, that doesn't mean you really know what radioactive dating is all about. I got my PhD at one of the foremost radioactive dating facilities in the U.S., so I watched radioactive dating occur, and I think when you watch it, you see it's sort of like watching sausage being made.
Yeah, all right. One thing. Now, I'm a radio talk show host and a pastor of Denver Bible Church, so I'm not a scientist, but I looked at the forms where we have submitted, we being our listeners, friends, scientists involved with our Real Science Radio show. We've submitted samples for radioactive dating, and on the forms themselves, they require you to say where you got the specimen, what your estimated age of the specimen is. So there's no such thing as double-blind test in the world of radioactive and carbon-14 dating. They don't do it.
Yeah, and actually what will happen, too, is when the dating is done, we're measuring how much of each isotope exists. And if we get an amount, we do several samples, so I get something to radioactively date, I'm going to cut it into several samples, and I'll do several samples.
Right.
And if one sample gives an amount of isotope that indicates the artifact is much older than the estimated date or much younger than the estimated date, those numbers are generally thrown out.
Right.
And usually we keep the numbers that are, fairly close to the estimated date.
And this is routine, so that let's say a paleontologist comes on a find that's especially important, say a skull 1470 out of Africa, East Rutherford. And so they want to date the skull. So they'll take the bones in the strata around the skull, above the skull, below the skull, they'll take the bones, and they not only will often get very discordant dates, often by extreme differences, but they'll take the same specimen and, as you just said, break it into pieces, the same rock or the same specimen, and get very different dates from the same specimen. So this is not as, we appreciate Dr. Stephen Meyer and especially his belief in Jesus Christ, but this is not a pure area of science like chemistry in a lab, for example.
Well, the process of actually measuring those isotopes is pure science.
Yes.
What's speculation is then inferring from that measured isotope level the age of whatever you're trying to date. That's where you get into a lot of speculation.
Well,
there are all sorts of assumptions.
Right. And the pure science, like you mentioned, with AMS, what is that, accelerated mass spectrometry, for carbon-14, I believe they're virtually counting individual carbon-14 atoms today. That is hard science. That's an extraordinary accomplishment. But could we give the audience an idea of the half-lives of different elements? Some are very long, as far as we know, and some are very short.
The half-life vary greatly depending on what you're talking about. So the half-life of carbon-14, for example, which is used in carbon dating, is 5,730 years. But another isotope that's used in radioactive dating is potassium-40. It has a half-life of 1.2 billion years.
So that's
almost a factor of a million between the two of them.
So from 6,000 to a billion, we have, I think it's polonium-214, has a half-life of about 8 minutes, which is very interesting, of course. And so all these different half-lives, they add up to potential data that scientists could investigate to try to find clues about the history of the Earth and life on Earth. Now, Dr. Jay Weil, when you're speaking in Denver this Friday, and that is July 12th, 7 p.m. at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship, for those who are able to come, Lord willing, my family and I, it's on our schedule to be there, so we expect to see you, Doctor. But it's at 21st and Wadsworth. It's Bethlehem Lutheran Chapel. So I strongly urge you guys to come on out to meet Dr. Jay Weil and to hear more about this, because Dr. Weil, as you mentioned earlier, you believe that the Earth is not billions of years old, and yet you have a PhD in nuclear chemistry. So how can that be?
Well, I was more than willing to believe in a billions of years old Earth when I started my graduate work in nuclear chemistry. The more I learned about nuclear chemistry and especially radioactive dating, the more skeptical I became of an Earth that's billions of years old. So it's actually learning how the sausage was made is what really told me that this whole idea. And I guess there's one other thing that really affected me greatly. I got my undergraduate in chemistry and then got my PhD in nuclear chemistry. Well, in chemistry, one thing you are taught very, very strongly is that you can only assume behavior over a short interval. So if I measure a system for 100 years, then I might be able to assume that the system will behave the same for the next 50 or the next 75 or maybe the next 100 years. But the longer your assumed interval exceeds your measured interval, the less reasonable the conclusion becomes.
Right.
To believe in a billions of years old Earth, you have to say, we've measured a system for 100 years, and it hasn't changed. So we're going to assume it doesn't change for a few billion years.
Mm-hmm.
So I am going to extrapolate over a factor of 10 million times. And that, as a chemist, you're taught that is just the worst thing you can possibly do from a data perspective.
Well, and what's interesting, and these are kinds of geochronometers to try to date the age of the Earth. And what's interesting is that there are many ways to attempt to date the age of the Earth, and many of those ways, as in dozens, like measuring the strength of the Earth's magnetic field and its steady decay rate, which we've been measuring also for 100 years very accurately. So there are so many methods of attempting to date the Earth that they yield results of only thousands of years old, just thousands. And the atheists that I interact with, the evolutionists, they say, well, that's a ridiculous assumption you're making, that half-life or, that magnetic field decay would be the same. But we're only saying it was the same for the last 10,000 years. You're saying it was the same for the last 4 billion years.
Yeah,
and they never
exactly
noticed that pattern.
What's even more crazy about that is some of these methods that we use to date the Earth that come up young, like the Earth's magnetic field, we understand planetary magnetic field significantly better than we understand radioactivity. So it is a much more reasonable statement to say the magnetic field decay has stayed fairly constant, because we understand how the magnetic field is generated. We understand what causes this kind of decay strength much better than we understand radioactivity. Radioactivity is still a mystery in a lot of ways. It's still throwing us surprises, and one of the things I'm talking about in this talk is one of the more recent surprises that radioactivity has thrown to us, and that is that radioactive decay is affected by the distance between the Earth and the Sun.
Wow.
It's a fairly new result. Mm-hmm. There was one lab that's been doing this for several years, and they were afraid to publish it because they couldn't understand what in the world it meant.
Right.
But now there have been three independent labs that have shown that certain types of radioactive decay vary depending on how far the Earth is from the Sun. Mm. And there is absolutely nothing we can explain this with. We don't understand anything about how this could be, but the data are pretty clear. So in the end, when a process throws you surprises like that, the last thing you can do is assume, make assumptions about it over billions of years.
Mm-hmm. And so we here at Bob and Yurt Live, what we've been doing is we collect what a lot of other people might consider to be anomalies, scientific observations. But we point out that there are so many of them, and they're from all over the world, and they're consistent. Maybe we can't call them anomalies anymore. And one of the examples, in fact, I have an interview this Friday with Dr. Paul Giem. Do you recognize his name?
Sure.
He's an expert researcher from Loma Linda University in California, I think recently retired, on carbon-14. And so we have been publishing examples where carbon-14, which only lasts a short amount of time, relatively speaking. Like, I think his example is, if the whole Earth were a ball of carbon-14, the half-life is so short that in less than a million years, you'd only have one atom left, and likely not even one atom. It'd all be decayed. And that's less than a million years. So then why do we find it everywhere it's not supposed to be, as in coal, oil, gas, diamonds, dinosaur bones with soft tissue in them, and on. It's just simply everywhere.
Right. Well, you know, people who want to believe in millions of billions of years will tell you that somehow the carbon-14 contaminated that sample.
Right.
But what you can do to prove that's wrong is you can show that there are actually trends in these data. It's not like there's some set amount of carbon-14. It varies depending on the type of sample you're using.
The type of sample, right?
That speaks against contamination. Contamination should be fairly uniform.
And also, in the whole industry, obviously, the industry of carbon-14 dating is a mature industry. It's been around for decades, and they have published in the peer-reviewed journals their procedures and their efforts not only to eliminate contamination from the lab, but also to identify when there is contamination by analyzing the data. And if you take a specimen like a diamond is one of the hardest, well, it is the hardest naturally occurring substance on Earth. And if you break open a diamond in laboratory conditions, and you then are counting many carbon-14 atoms from the middle of that diamond, there is strong evidence that's endogenous carbon-14. It came from within that specimen.
Yeah, and you could do the same with dinosaur bones. I mean, you can soak them in acid to get rid of all the mineral version of carbon and so forth, so that the only carbon left should be organic carbon from the bone. And you get the same, you see the same thing. This dinosaur bone is supposed to be hundreds or millions of tens of millions of years old, and yet it has enough carbon-14 data in it to indicate it may be 30 or 50,000 years old.
Right. And so then, and I never quite understood the point you just made about cleaning the dinosaur specimen. And it turns out that if you have collagen from dinosaurs, which today that's like old news. We have blood vessels, blood cells, DNA from a hadrosaur. We've got so many proteins. So if you have collagen, a structural protein, and you purify it, so let's say your specimen is 95% pure collagen or 99% pure collagen. If you have carbon-14 in there, it cannot be the carbon in the collagen molecules because collagen molecules are not going to allow the physics of it. They're not going to be replaced by modern carbon. It's just not going to happen. You would have the collagen breaking down. You're not going to have collagen. So if you have collagen, in fact, that collagen is not contaminated with carbon-14.
Well, it's certainly not contaminated from the outside, because the only, basically the only form of contamination from the outside is mineral. And if you, you know, get rid of the minerals with acid, then in the end, what you're left with is organic carbon. And that's, you know, that's coming from the fossil itself.
Well, right. Because even bacteria, people say, well, bacteria got in and contaminated it, but bacteria do not produce collagen molecules, collagen
right,
proteins.
Yeah, exactly.
So strong arguments. How about, can I ask you another question about what the atheists say to rebut this? I know it's
sure.
a bit technical, but then they'll say, well, the specimen was buried in under the ground, and there's something called neutron capture. And so by a radioactive process, sort of in reverse, these atoms captured neutrons. Like maybe it's in a uranium mine or something. And so,
yeah, well, this is a really desperate argument, because you can make a quick calculation. We know how probable it is. I mean, we've measured this for a long time. We know how probable it is for carbon 13 to absorb a neutron and become carbon 14, or for carbon 12 to absorb two neutrons and become carbon 14. Mm. These numbers have been measured long ago. We understand them very well. And, you know, I actually made a calculation for, you know, an atheist I was having a discussion with to show that this is just utterly wrong, because if you surround a gram of carbon with a gram of uranium,
right,
even if you surround it with a gram of uranium, you're not going to get enough carbon-14 production to
explain
have,
what we're finding.
Right, yeah, to have the amount that we're finding.
Right. Right.
It's off by about an order of magnitude.
Dr.
And like I said, these calculations are very easy to do if you know the physics behind it.
Dr. Jonathan Sarfati of the Creation Ministries International, he has pointed out that you would need so much uranium in the specimen to explain the carbon-14 in coal that we would no longer call it coal, we'd call it uranium.
Uranium, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so those are sort of secondary arguments that the atheist uses and the evolutionist when they find carbon-14 where it shouldn't be. So then they say, well, it must be contamination or it must be neutron capture. But what's interesting is they largely accept carbon-14 dating across the board everywhere except for where carbon-14 is found in specimens that they claim are millions or billions of years old.
Yeah, and it's an interesting psychological study, because if you ask most people who adhere to an old Earth, why is it that these dinosaur bones date so young with carbon-14 dating, their answer is, well, you can't use carbon-14 on old bones. Or if you ask them, why is it that hundreds of year old lava flows date as millions of years old with potassium argon dating? They'll say, well, you can't use potassium argon dating on young samples. But my question is, if you don't know the date, if you're using your technique
right.
because you're trying to find out the date, how do you know whether it's old or young to begin with?
So when there are specimens that we know the age of, we know when this rock solidified, and the radiometric dating is so much in error, then why should
right.
we trust it for the rocks that we don't know how old they are? And
exactly, yeah. That's and that was the first sort of inkling I got when I was doing my graduate work, that there's something wrong with this billions of years nonsense.
Mm-hmm. So when you come and speak, your talk is Variable Radioactive Half-Lives, Current Evidence. So are you going to be speaking mostly about this new discovery that I was unaware of until you said it, that half-lives...
That's one of the ones I'm talking about. I'm going to talk about some older stuff, the stuff in 2000, what was it, 5 or 6, from the Institute for Creation Research, where they showed that the helium content in zircons indicated, a burst of radioactive decay sometime in the past.
Yes.
And I'm also going to talk about what's often called the heat problem, if radioactive decay was accelerated in the past, as you know, as most creationists think, then in the end there would be a buildup of heat because radioactive decay produces heat, and that's called the heat problem. And I'm going to give my take on the heat problem.
Well, thank you. This is those issues are of great interest to me. As a biblical creationist, I accept Jesus Christ's testimony of the events in Genesis, that they were actual history. Jesus and the New Testament authors spoke of the global flood, Noah, the ark, Noah's family. Jesus said that God made us male and female at the beginning of the creation. So that's not after 13 billion years, but he said at the beginning, not at the end. And so these issues are of great interest to me because I like to be ready to give an answer to those who ask. But there are, of course, the world's a big place. There are many things that we creationists are still trying to figure out. So I'm excited about you coming out. We only have another minute. Could I ask, have you heard of experiments in Kiev in the Ukraine at a research lab, Proton 21 research lab? Have you heard about those?
Yeah, and, you know, I've looked at a lot of his graphs and so forth. I'm not really... convinced that he's seeing what he thinks he's seeing. I understand that, you know, he's seeing an elevation of some of these elements, and he thinks it's because plasma has induced fusion.
Right.
I think that's a very tricky thing to see. The biggest concern I have is he doesn't see anything new. He only sees increases in what was there already, at least from the graphs I've seen.
Okay.
And that's a red flag to me.
All right. Well, I appreciate that because that's something we're interested in also, what they're doing over there in
Kiev.
All right. Well, Dr. Jay Weil, thank you so very much, and we really look forward to seeing you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for the interview.
Well, you're very welcome. So that is Dr. Jay Weil. He'll be here Friday evening at 7 o'clock at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. I strongly encourage you to come on out. My sons and I will be there. Hey, I'll see if Cheryl... Now, Cheryl is not as into science as, you know, I'm obsessed by it. But Cheryl is big time into theology, personhood, and the whole issue of how best to protect unborn children. She's also into our kids and all, you know. But having her come out to hear a PhD in nuclear chemistry, I don't know. But I'll try... But you come out. We'll have a good time. God bless you.